Over a year ago, a devastating tornado ripped through Joplin, Missouri, killing scores of people and just horrendous damage as well. I narrated for some people who are very, very familiar with Joplin and care deeply about the distress and the survival and the recovery. They did a documentary on Joplin. It's called Joplin, Missouri, A Tornado Story, and I narrated it for them. And they are going to be debuting it in St. Louis. It's been shown already in Joplin, but this is going to be in St. Louis Monday night, July 9. So those of you in the St. Louis area and Illinois across the river here, just circle your calendar July 9th at 7 p.m. It's at the Tivoli Theater. And those of you in this area know where that is. The Tivoli Theater, that'll be July 9th at 7 p.m. I'm going to be there in the beginning. I have donated a number of my books to this cause, and I'll be there signing it to people who want to buy them with the money and the proceeds going to the Joplin folks. And then I've got to get off later on and get ready for the program, of course, that night. But do come by if you can. Monday, July 9th, 7 p.m. at the Tivoli Theater. And we'll be back in a moment with your open line calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. It's open line time, and let's go to Pittsburgh. Nicholas is there. Good morning, Nicholas.
Hi, good morning, George. How are you?
Good. Thanks for holding so long.
Oh, no, that's fine. Well, I wanted to ask you something. You have, like, so many guests on your show that I think if you stick with it, one day you're going to be one of the wisest people in the country.
If I remember everything.
Yeah. I think you should run for president one day. And I feel like we have a lot of things to work out in our country. And I feel like a lot of people are misdirected, and there's a lot of big corporations that are taking advantage of us. And I'm all for a free economy and everything, but I think that the American people are almost brain dead. And I've heard a lot of your guests talk about how we're almost zombified and walking around in a nameless state and subscribing to corporatism and everything. And I've been trying to think of – oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, you're right. I mean, I would love to get a candidate in there that thinks about us first and everybody else later, but I don't know if that's ever going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you know how many viewers that you have on your show?
It ranges anywhere from 3 to 6, 7 million every other night. Millions, if you add them up during the week, it could go into 15 to 20 million. So,
oh, wow. If all of them talked to three people and had convinced three people to vote for a president, I think the president we have now had 64 million votes to get into office.
Yeah.
And I would love to hear you talk more about, you know, things that we can all do and get together to do to help save our country. And I had this idea. I was trying to think of ways that we could all save money. And I thought about cell phone towers. And once they're built, they're built. They're just large, giant antennas.
That's right.
Yet somehow we all pay money to corporations. $50 a month, and they make a profit off of us
forever.
And yes, forever and ever. And what if we got together as a society and built our own towers, so that way we had at-cost access to them? Do you think that goes along the lines of socialism, or if that's an American idea that we can do?
You know, that's kind of a novel idea. I think that's more of, you know, some kind of community sharing. It's not a bad idea, and you are correct. We pay this tower fee built into our cell phone costs forever, even though they've advertised, they've already picked up the cost, and they've paid for these things in great form or fashion. I used to hear that people who used to have cell phone towers and would lease the land to these companies just made a fortune on that, probably still are. Let's go to Picayune, Mississippi. It's Mike's turn, east of the Rockies. Hey, Mike, go ahead.
Hi, George. It's me again, calling from Picayune. And
there you are.
Yeah. I had heard earlier, I work overnight, so I'm always up at night. But I kind of dozed off, and I got in the middle of the the first guest, the first hour, and I had a near-death experience story that I was not me, but my mother and my father. I lost them both about the time of Katrina. My mother in 2007, my father right before then, and my mother was in the hospital, and she was a nurse, and there was a lady in the hospital that knew my mother, and I was in the cafeteria, and I, you know, you wonder about the next life, and you wonder about what's on the other side.
Sure.
You know,
always.
Especially when things like that are going on. My condolences to you on your losing your father. My father was
a World War II vet too. Yeah. Oh boy. They're going. There's not too many left. You know.
Oh, I know. It's getting less and less every week. You know.
Every week. Yep.
But my mother, I was worrying about, of course, and I'm thinking about the other side, and I hear about near-death experiences, and so I asked this lady, she was a nurse, you know, have you ever seen anything in the hospital, or, you know, since you've been a nurse for a while that made you, you know, that really stuck out? And she said, well, let me tell you, I'm very careful what I say around people who are dying, even what I think. And she says, I had a lady come into the emergency room when I was working in the ER, and she was an elderly woman, and they brought her in, and she was deceased. She was DOA, but they revived her. And the doctor thought she was stable. We'll move her to the ICU. So they moved her to the ICU, and you know, I don't know whether you know how it is in the ER, but sometimes they might work for 18 or 20 hours, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've been there.
Right.
Not as a doctor, but as a patient. Hate
right.
those places.
And so she says, well, I'm going to go get something to eat, because she'd been there for quite a while at the time, 12 or 13 hours. And she went to the cafeteria. She went through the line. She got her dinner, and she was just about to sit down. And this lady code blued on them. And she thought to herself, you know, an expletive, which I can't say on the radio, but she says, oh, shoot, you know, but she didn't say shoot.
You know? Yeah, right.
And so she jumped up and she ran to they went and got the crash cart. They went down to they ran to her room, and they worked on her again, and they got her back where they thought she was stable again. Well, a couple of days later, the lady was making rounds. And she was looking at charts and stuff.
Uh-huh.
And she was in this lady's room, and the lady says, you know, she says, I really like you, you know. And she says, I'm not going to be around much longer. And, you know, doctors and nurses, they just try to reassure everybody no matter what's going on. They go, oh, yeah, no, you're going to be fine. Your vitals are fine. And, you know, I don't have any reason to think that. She says, no. She says, I'm 80 whatever years old. She was And she says, my time has come. My time has come. And she says, you know, I really like you, and I appreciate what you and the doctors are trying to do, but I'm not going to make it. And she says, before I go, I want to apologize to you for interrupting your dinner the other evening.
Oh, my gosh.
I think it's one of the most compelling stories of that kind.
Can you believe that? She's dying. People are scrambling to save her life, and she's concerned that she's spoiled everybody's dinner.
Well, she thought she had hers, so apparently she must have been able to see her where she was. And I guess, you know, she just wanted to make amends. And, you know, I just thought that was a really interesting story, George, and I wanted you to hear it.
All right, great. Thanks for sharing it with us. Hey, by the way, holiday note for you. Strange one this time. July 4th falls on a Wednesday. That's weird, which means people get July 4th off, most people, but you have to go back to work on Thursday and Friday. You don't get that 2 or 3 day squeezed in there. But we will have a live show for you Wednesday night, obviously, July 4th. You know the deal. Holiday, we work, we're there. One of us always, and this is my week, so... July 4th, live program for you. Skype we go. Phil is with us in Boulder, Colorado. Hey, Phil, go ahead.
Hey, George, how are you?
I'm doing good, thank you.
Well, I actually have a couple of things to talk to you about, but in order to kind of get an entry here, I wanted to tell you a story that I knew the original games design, one of the original designers who designed what we are seeing today as World War III. That was actually they designed this back in the late 70s at the U.S. Military War College.
Was this like a program, a computer program?
No, he was actually a board games designer. He designed Civil War games, but then he was one of the first people that took Reuters and started designing gaming into the business design.
Okay.
He came out with some big award-winning products. But he related this story to me that back in the late 70s, he was part of this gaming design company that was hired by the U.S. Military War College to basically teach them war from an electronic and from a gaming design point of view. And he said, he met up with the Russian military advisor at the time. And he said, and this guy knew every single thing, every single troop movement. He knew where all the strengths. That was his job. He was on loan from the Pentagon. And he said, but he didn't know how to play the game of war. And he said, so let me teach you the game of war. He says, I design Civil War games. And in a Civil War game, everybody starts at the end of the field. They rattle their sabers. And they shouted at each other. This has been going on for, generations.
Yeah.
He says, but what they were doing is they were really flanking them during that period. And then as the other side is kind of getting a little shaken up, they rush in and they crush them from the side. Right? And
good point.
It was the art of distraction. And he said, so let's teach you how to play the game of war. He says, let's just have some fun. Let's go to the, South African harbor. And he said, that's a kind of a neutral zone at the time. And he says, and let's just bring up a sub, and let's just shoot everybody. Okay, and then let's disappear.
Everybody on land, just shoot them all.
Just shoot them all, okay, irregardless. Even shoot yourself. Okay, and then disappear. And he says, and then let somebody else take the blame.
All right.
And let some other group, rally and take the blame. He says, and while we're doing that, he says, let's go to another part of the world. Let's go to Afghanistan. And let's start a coup. And again, we'll do the same sort of thing, and we'll blame it on the Russians.
And then we get out of there.
And then we get out of there. And he says, and this is what the game of war starts to be. He says, and by the end of the week, he says, everybody, all the military advisors from the Pentagon knew how to play war. And I have literally been watching, because he went into great detail on this. But I have literally been watching everything for the last 30 years come down. I think the only thing that I think that threw me off was the 9/11 incident. But I knew about, the gold coming out of China back in the 30s. So, that one was that's just another pure distraction.
Incredible strategy, Phil, isn't it?
Yeah, that's I've seen that same thing going on in corporations. For the last 30 years, I was a chief technology officer for IBM. I could tell you some, crazy things. Here's a good one. I'll give you a little story on that one.
All right.
Back in the late 80s or the early 80s, around 84, IBM was sitting on literally several billion dollars of chips that they had no market for. They were the early first programming chips, so they're actually programming real design into the chips. And so what they did is they came out with this a unique way to go to market, and they had about a half a dozen vendors for each set of chips. And I was working at Martin Marietta at the time, and the first shipment of IBMs came in. And when I opened all of them, I looked inside, and every single one had the same design but had different chips from different manufacturers in each spot.
Okay.
And I suddenly realized that they were onto this master strategy, because what they did is that means that they could literally stranglehold and control any of those chips up to, those licensors. Anybody that got out of line, they could just basically, put them in litigation, shut them down for a while. So they kept this open competition. And then, what they did is they built that unit, and they actually spent more than they actually sold it for. They were actually taking a loss on this first 200 units. You may remember they sold their first order was for 250,000, and the market order was for 2.5 million units.
Right, right.
Okay? And what they did is they literally created a market over in, like, China for this. They basically wanted the clone market. And remember they were yelling back in those gray market days that everybody was ripping them off?
Yeah, they wanted that.
They wanted that because, in actuality, every one of those clones built in China still had to buy the chips for the design from one of those licensed manufacturers. So every single unit that was sold was making money for IBM.
All those obsolete chips they got rid of.
That's how they got rid of them all.
Genius marketing, wasn't it?
And that's how they literally came to market. They literally planned from the year that they shipped it, the 20 years from that date, they would literally shut the doors, totally turn around, and go back and become a corporate-run market.
Well, hey, that's what corporations do. They're smart, most of them. Let's go to Jesus in Sunnyside, Washington. Good morning, Jesus.
Hey, do you remember me about the Mothman story I told you a while back?
I sure do.
Yeah. Well, I had a question. What do you do if you see a gray? Like, just if you wake up and you're not paralyzed, or if you walk outside and it's just there?
Well, let's be specific. Where would the gray be?
Well, but like hiding. Like, if it was hiding from you, or if it was just out in the open.
All right, so not in your bedroom, outside somewhere.
Yes.
Would you be afraid of it? I need to know that.
Well, I have, like, if I get afraid, I kind of get a little violent. That's natural human being thing to do. Well,
so you attack instead of run away. You know what? I would initially be very comfortable with this gray, as long as it's not attempting to try to hurt you or do something to you. I try to be pretty friendly with it, as a matter of fact. I think you both could learn something. I really do. So I wouldn't run away at all. Let's go to Daniel in Washington, state of. Welcome to the show. Hi, Daniel.
Hello.
Hey, go ahead.
George, I'm on the wild card line, but this is my first time calling with you. And,
that's all right.
Yeah, very, very pleased to be on your show. Not my reason for calling. I kind of want to get off on a little side note and say that I would like to see a lot more information being spread out about, you know, the global banking, you know, conspiracy that's pretty much enslaving the planet at this current time. And I don't know. I don't know if that's something that you guys really want to touch on.
Yeah, we do that. We do that. You know, it's part of the balance of the show. We've done two, maybe three of those a year, full shows.
Yeah. But my reason for calling, I heard, you know, quite a few people sharing their stories about, you know, the afterlife and the other side. And just thought I'd like to share my experience back in 2007. I'd spent several years dating this girl. Yeah.
All right, and hold on right there, Daniel. We're going to hit this break, and I want you to have time to finish your story the proper way for you. So don't go anywhere. We're going to come right back with you, Daniel in Washington. We'll talk about his story from the afterlife and the rest of you. More Open Lines continue on Coast to Coast AM. First of all, time for our traditional shout-out. Thanks for supporting Coast to Coast AM. Those of you listening to your favorite radio stations across North America, hello. Coast Insiders, thank you for all you do. XM Talk, Channel 168. Then how about the various chat room and groups all around the planet? Coast to Coast Elite Group, The Imaginative Worlds, Into Infinity, Fantastic Forum 2, National Radio Club, The Sorcery IRC, those who follow us on Facebook and Twitter, the Northern Kentucky Paranormal Group, the Nighthawk Nation, Above Top Secret, the SoCal UFO meetup group. This thing just keeps growing. And the Hollywood Ghost Hunters and our buddy Greg the Cook in St. Louis. Thanks for supporting Coast to Coast AM. Now let's go back to Daniel in Washington. He can tell us his story. He's been waiting long. Daniel, go ahead. I didn't want you on hold too long.
Well, thanks, George.
Okay, my friend.
Yeah, so in 2007, a beautiful, beautiful woman that I'd been dated for several years, troubled, you know, sadly, very troubled. She committed suicide. Oh. And you know. Naturally, I went through some, you know, pretty interesting range of emotions after that.
Sure,
but
of course.
I started having these dreams. And in these dreams, she was visiting me. And I'm convinced, you know, I believe very firmly in the afterlife, you know. And I believe that people who have passed on, especially traumatically, you know, they tend to linger. Or, you know, as the previous callers were talking about, you know, just learning to let go and move on, you know. And pretty much that's what, you know, was happening here. Initially, when I would see, you know, we'd be in this dream together, you know, she was living in this house, utter chaos, just disarray, you know, and just not herself, just not knowing what was going on. She had the gun that she had, you know, entered her life with, and I was trying to convince her that you are already dead, but she wouldn't listen. As these dreams would progress, we'd be meeting in a grocery store and having coffee and talking about it. And, you know, she was looking better and, you know, acknowledging, yes, I'm, you know, I am no longer here, but, you know, we have these times, you know.
Right.
And then by the end of it, the last dream that I had with her, I was crossing a bridge with her, and we got to the middle of the bridge. It was just a crazy, one of those rope bridges you'd expect to see in a jungle over this huge chasm. And we got to the halfway point, and she turned around and said to me, you can't go any farther. You have to go back. And we both just kind of said our goodbyes, and, well, I haven't had a dream about her since. That was a couple years ago now.
She moved on, finally.
But, you know, I truly feel like I was part of the process of her accepting what had happened to her.
Yep, you sure were.
You know, and...
And at the same time, Daniel, it helped you.
It did, absolutely did, you know. Yeah, it was kind of odd. Her name was Cammy, which in Japanese means ghost or spirit.
Wow.
Yeah, I thought that was weird. I didn't know that. I didn't figure that one out until after she had moved on. But the good ending to the story was, you know, my despair made me pick up the phone and call one of my best friends from high school, whom I happened to pretty much love unconditionally for, you know, all the years that I didn't see her. And she pretty much sewed me back together. And now we're married going on 4 or 5 years and have, you know, some wonderful children to raise. And life is certainly taking a turn for the better.
That is great. Daniel, thanks for having the fortitude to share the story with us.
Yeah, it's not something I talk about too much, but I figured tonight was the night, you know. A lot of those previous callers a while back, they kind of struck some chords with me, and I just felt compelled to call and share. So,
all right, my friend. Great. Thank you. And we'll be back with more Open Lines on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back. Open Lines here. This is one of our 3-hour Open Liners tonight. We still got another hour to go next hour. Let us go back to the phones. We'll go to Sacramento, California. Mike is with us, west of the Rockies. Hey, Mike, thanks. Go ahead.
George, how are you?
Good, Michael.
Okay, I got one. Goes back to the 70s. I came up with this idea that this was after the Beatles did their concert at Candlestick Park. If they would come back together and do one song, they could probably feed half the hungry people in the world, if not all of them, because people were buying albums in those days.
Yeah.
And so I was kicking her back and forth with my wife, and I had all these ideas. Who introduced the Beatles first? It was Ed Sullivan. And I thought, well, who was the voice back in the 70s? It was Howard Cosell. So I said, well, Howard Cosell could probably do it. I said, but nobody's going to listen to me on this. It's like talking to the wind, you know? So I got this idea that maybe I could find a teacher with a class, and I started collecting piggy banks and all kinds, all shapes, all sizes of banks, just small little coin banks, and I'd fill them with change and mostly pennies, but I'd fill them up, and I had them all over the house, garage sales, Goodwills, everywhere I could find an old piggy bank, I'd buy it. I must have had 200-300 of them. And we walked in the house one night, and turn a TV on, and Howard Cosell was saying how John Lennon was just shot and killed in front of the Dakota Apartments.
That's right.
And he pretty much said exactly what I said he would say, the boys who grew up in the New England slums, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And so I said, well, that idea's gone, and I bagged up all these little coin banks, and there was like four bags, big garbage bags, and I put them in my mom's basement under a bench, and then said, well, I'll work on it down the line. And then when George Harrison died, I thought, well, that's it. There's no more Beatles coming back together. So I went over at 6 o'clock in the morning to my mom's. I woke her up. I said, hey, I want to get those bags out of there. I took a cab over and had the driver take me out to Candlestick Park, and there's a little baseball diamond Candlestick Park shadows this little baseball diamond. So I put these banks all over the field and the bases and the home plate and took pictures of them and everything and figured, well, that's it. Now, I ran into Gene Hackman in a bar one night in the marina, a restaurant actually, a Barker Room, and I was really, really had a drinking problem since that happened. Even before that happened with John Lennon, I had a drinking problem right up to when I ran into Gene Hackman in this place. And I'm quoting all the movies he made and all the lines from all the movies, just making a total spectacle of myself. And he listened to me for 15 or 20 minutes and didn't say a word. Okay? And then...
And you're just going on and on and
I'm going on, bite the bullet, you know, how when you and Jimmy Coburn come to the end and tied it up, it was, you know, blah, blah, blah. Every line from every movie, Scarecrow, all of them. And he finally looks at me, he says, I am Gene Hackman. And the bartender says, hey, Mike, you better go home, man. You've had a little too much. It was pouring down rain outside. So I turned around and I left. And I said to him before I left, I said, oh, you're probably wearing all the clothes you wore in Scarecrow. And there was a few times when he really wanted to laugh,
yeah,
but he didn't want to encourage me, right?
Right.
And this is 2004. I hadn't had a drink since, okay? Not to this second. I haven't had a drink since. And I was thinking about it about 2 or 3 months ago. I was thinking about that story, and so I went online to see what happened to Gene Hackman, because he hadn't made any movies, and someone emailed and said he quit making movies in 2004. He was on Larry King and was talking about it, and I was wondering if it was because I made I made a ridiculous spectacle of myself, and he figures that that's what my fans are turning into. I might as well forget it. That night, I was calling in, Tom was on the line, and I had called in, you were talking about weird stuff, as usual, right? And I called in to say how I just got out of the hospital. I was walking across the street, no cars were coming, and I stopped to light a cigarette, and a tree fell down right in front of me. And Tom didn't think it was, you know, he kept me on hold for 2 hours. And making a long story short, in the same newscast that night, I heard that Gene Hackman had been in a bicycle accident in Florida.
That's right.
And he was okay, and everything was cool. And I said, wow, that's a coincidence. And in the same newscast, I heard that Sean and Julian might get together with Ringo and Paul and cut an album. And I thought that was very, very... I get a lot of coincidences.
Yeah.
I call,
well, there are no coincidences. Synchronicity.
Synchronicity. I called you once. I want to thank you, because I called you once back in 2006, and it was your worst lie night. And I gave you the worst lie I ever told, and it was so bad, George, you had to go to a commercial right after.
I remember that. Michael, thanks. We got a few more calls here. Thanks for the call. Thanks for the memories, too. Let's go to Jonathan in Seattle to get us going. Jonathan, go ahead.
I was just wondering, what will happen to the U.S. economy in 10 years?
Well, now, that's an interesting possibility. What will happen in the U.S. economy in 10 years? Honestly, I don't know what will happen to the U.S. economy in 1 year. A lot of things could happen. Many things could change. It'll either be humming along, or it'll be in deep trouble. I'm not sure which. Jack is in Lancaster, Kentucky, and he's on Coast to Coast, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, Jack.
Hey, good morning, George. Thanks for having me on.
Good morning to you. You too.
I guess I'll tell you a story that's kind of strange, and I'll try to give you the condensed version.
Okay.
Back in Texas in 2004, I was behind a microphone doing sort of the same thing you did. I was working at a classic rock station, and a guy had gotten a hold of me who had built a jet-powered dragster, and he got the frame from a gentleman that actually started it out in Southern California and put his own jet engine in the car and basically was just wanting to help me, get me to help him to promote it. And we kind of did some stuff together, and I remember going out to the track in the town that we lived in and watching him run it and thinking, God, if that thing ever got away from him, you know, whoever was downwind of it would be in big trouble. Little did I know, a couple of years later, that somebody would be me. And on February the 8th, 2004, I was at that same track, and he had taken the car and gotten it reworked. And the car broke in half.
Oh, my God.
And flew out of control. And I was standing beside a pickup truck waiting down at the end of the track, and it flew in the air at 250 miles per hour, and it hit me against his pickup truck. And I was never knocked unconscious. It severed both my legs.
Oh.
It pushed all of my internal organs up into my chest cavity and collapsed my lungs. And I was knocked 40 feet from, I actually saw the car coming at me and tried to pull myself on the hood away from the car coming at me, and I didn't make it, and it hit me and knocked me backwards. And I lie half in the dirt and halfway on the track. My nephew was visiting from out of state, and my wife and my son were there. My son was only 4 years old at that time, and my nephew was the first one down to see, you know, and when he came upon me, he was just almost...
Oh, in shock.
Yeah, he was, and I remember his motorcycle. He was on his motorcycle, which is one of the reasons why we went. The gentleman that owned the car had called me to help him because his two children who were in the pickup truck were too young to help him, and I was the only person he had. And his wife, and by the way, his wife and two sons were in the car, were in the pickup truck that I towed him with to the line, because this car, the jet car, has no transmission or anything like a piston engine vehicle.
Right.
So I would retrieve him after he'd make the run and pull him back to the pit stop. We'd repack the chutes and refuel it and do it again. So, but anyway, His youngest son was looking out the back window of the truck, and I'd had this reoccurring dream the month before. This happened in February. In January, I had the same dream where the little boy was screaming bloody murder. And sure enough, I looked up when I was lying there, and he was screaming out the back window, and it all came to me. This was supposed to have happened. Well, my nephew had come up, and the headlight of the motorcycle was shedding enough light. I looked down, and I picked up my right leg, and it fell off just below the knee, and just a piece of skin was holding it on. And my left leg was, the femur was sticking through the skin. It was bad. And I was a medic in the Air Force, so I knew triage, and I was like, I can make it, but I don't know how much of this they can fix.
You must have been bleeding like crazy.
Oh, I had arterial bleeding. Every time my heart beat, the gravel would shoot away. And
who saved you?
Well, there was an ambulance at the track, but it was a holdout old Chevrolet van, and it had black electrical tape written ambulance on the side. And all it had was a stretcher and a cervical collar. They had nary, as they say around these parts, they had nary a tourniquet or Band-Aid even. And they went to the car because after the jet car hit me, the engine ripped out of the chassis, out of the frame. All four wheels broke loose and went out in the desert, and it caught the grass on fire. So they went to the where the, you know, the action was. Nobody had even knew that I'd gotten hit except for his family.
How long did it take you to come back to where you are now, basically?
About 2.5-3 years to rehab back to where, you know, I wear one prosthetic leg on the right. I have nothing on the left because it's too cumbersome. Actually, I have a prosthetic on my left. 8 days after I made it to San Antonio, I died. I was dead for 15 minutes, which is why I'm calling you. If you don't believe there's an afterlife, I'm telling you, I was dead for over 15 minutes. On the fourth try, they brought me back. I did die. I did go to another place. There is an afterlife.
Did they send you back, Jack?
Yeah, they did. I get emotional about it. It's hard to talk about. There are angels.
How old are you now? Can I ask you that?
George. It's real.
I wish I could tell you
it's not, man, but it is. And I hear a lot of people, and that's why I love your show. What you do is awesome. And why you don't have a Marconi Award is beyond me. And if you do, I'm sorry, I didn't know. But you're a godsend, man. It's special what you do. And
we don't apply for awards. You know, I used to do that. I did that in the old days.
You should have them all. I was fortunate. I am blind from it. You don't die for that long and not have some sort of brain damage. I should have ended up brain dead, but I didn't. Actually, I'm finishing my undergrad at the University of Kentucky as we speak.
Good for you.
And I learned.
You're an inspiration.
Well,
unbelievable.
Thank you so much, and I think you are. But
I didn't go through what you went through.
I'm actually a published author. I wrote my autobiography, and I'm not here to plug the book. I'm just telling you.
Well, go ahead.
Well, it's called Surviving My Life, and it's all the usual places. In Amazon.com, you can find it. And I wrote about my life here in Kentucky growing up and my life in the Air Force. I think you're an Air Force officer at one time,
Navy.
Weren't you?
Navy for me.
I'm sorry, I should be ashamed. My father was.
Don't ever get that wrong, Jack.
Yeah, I know. I'm the son of a sailor, no pun intended.
You know
my father was Navy, and my grandfather was an officer in the Navy. And I broke tradition and went Air Force. But we're proud to have served. But it's just life is short, and I can't wait to go back where I was before, because I'll tell you right now, now I'll let you go, but the pressure of the world was off my shoulders where I went. And George, I've listened, I'm 48 years old. I've listened to music all my life. I've got right now in my bedroom, I have thousands of dollars worth of guitars surrounding me, acoustic, electric, you name it. And I've never heard the music like I heard when I was rising through the clouds to go where I was going. The angels were singing. And I can't put into words the
well, I want to do one thing here for you, Jack, while we hit the top of the hour. I've got you on hold. I want you to give Gina your phone number. We're going to get it to Tom. I'm going to get Billy Gibbons from ZZ Top to send you something, okay? You may be one of the most inspirational calls I've ever heard. We'll be back in a moment. More open lines on Coast to Coast AM.